Avenue Beach despite huge waves and fierce winds. 46-year-old Stanislaw Wozlik Jr. was pulled from the water. He was pronounced dead at a hospital, and an autopsy determined that he had drowned. In sports, in the NFL, it's a short week for the Packers as they meet Seattle on the road this Thursday evening. Yesterday, the Pack beat Miami 31-12. The Bears defeated the Lions 34-22. In the NBA yesterday, the Bucks beat the Denver Nuggets 121-114. All five Bucks starters scored in double figures, and four of them had 20 points or more. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy skies today. Some temperatures running some 15 degrees below normal for this time of year with a high of 33 forecast. Northwest winds at 10 to 15. Clear skies tonight, a low of 13. Tomorrow, sunshine. A little cooler, if anything, though. Tomorrow's high, 26. Expanded forecast for the tail end of the work week. A slight warming trend with dry conditions continuing. Thursday and Friday, we're expecting highs of around 40. Still pretty cold for this time of year. Right now, clouds and 29. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. It's exactly 8:12, and we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. There is a special event that is coming up this week on Friday, November 16th at 6 p.m. at Rustic Road Brewery Company in downtown Kenosha. And this event is called Clock Out, a conversation about the future of your job. And this is an event that is co-sponsored by Carthage College and the Wisconsin Humanities Council. And a very special guest is coming in to speak for this. Her name is Holly Painter, and she is an English lecturer at the University of Vermont and the creator of something truly fascinating called the Obsolete Jobs Project, In Search of Endangered Jobs, in which she gathers together the stories of a plethora of different people who have jobs that may sometime, perhaps even in the near future, vanish. Jobs that will in some manner or form cease to exist, cease to be needed. And it is such an intriguing thing to contemplate. And of course, one has to also think about the fact that many jobs have already, for the most part at least, disappeared from the face of the earth. Jobs that once upon a time were part and parcel to daily life and daily interaction. And we're going to find out from Holly Painter why she put this project together and what we can learn about it. I want to mention that in her biography, in which she outlines where she secured her education, she also mentions her previous job experience as ice cream scooper, cemetery grounds crew, university sexual health clinic front desk person, youth group volunteer coordinator, poet for hire, field trips intern at a kids writing nonprofit, and an academic copy editor. And she is my guest for this part of the morning show. Holly Painter, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's very nice to talk with you.
I'm very excited about this. I really enjoyed visiting your website, which is obsoleteontheroad.wordpress.com. Explain at what point you created this thing called the Obsolete Jobs Project. What prompted you to do this?
Well, so I am a poet as my sort of how I think a lot of this project is thinking about how people's identities intersect their jobs. And for me, I consider myself a poet. And I was having a conversation with my partner about how that is not a lucrative profession and perhaps not even a needed profession. And I sort of said, well, obsolete jobs are really interesting. If this is an obsolete job, I want to find the rest of the obsolete people and see what they're doing and how are they hanging on and how are they making their jobs and their identities intersect in these interesting ways. Hmm. That was 2014. I was living in Singapore at the time and working freelance work. At that point, I was an academic copy editor and also a poet for hire, as you read. And so I had a lot of flexibility and was able to fly to the U.S. and spent 6 weeks the first trip, just driving around. I went to something like 24 states and interviewed 45 people that time.
Wow. How did you track these people down? How did you find them?
Well, I took kind of three approaches. First, I put a thing on Facebook to everyone I knew and said, who do you know that has one of these jobs? And I'd sort of made a list for people to look at. And then I also used LinkedIn, which means that there were people who were technically savvy enough to have gotten themselves onto LinkedIn and just pretty much exhausted as much as LinkedIn would let me do without upgrading to a recruiter account and just going through people's profiles and finding places that I knew I was going to stop off, who had these jobs in those places. And then the third thing I did, which was the most intimidating, was just to walk up to people. I'd go to a cobbler's shop in South Carolina and just walked up and said, hi, I'm doing this this project. I have my camera and my recorder. Can I interview you?
Hmm.
That was how I found people.
Wow. So by and large, how has this overture or invitation been received by people? And I ask that because I think sometimes it might be possible to find somebody with a job that is obsolete or soon to be obsolete who maybe has never stopped to think about that and perhaps might either be disconcerted or even offended a little bit by the very notion that what they are doing is an obsolete job that might very well vanish at some point in the future. Or by and large, were people comfortable talking about this and welcoming the opportunity?
Most people, if I phrased it correctly, understood that I wasn't saying that they were unnecessary or that they were somehow not valuable, but just that various trends had made it such that there weren't so many people in their occupation anymore. And so most people were pretty comfortable with that. And I think for the most part, the people that I've spoken to, this wasn't the first time this occurred to them. I did have a few people who kind of understood obsolete in a more pejorative sense and thought I was making some commentary on the value of what they did or the meaning of what they did. And so those people didn't want me to interview them. Hmm. I didn't.
Right. When we bring up your website, which is beautifully designed, by the way, the first thing we see on the screen are these big words, Obsolete Jobs Project in Search of Endangered Jobs. And right behind it is a really interesting photograph. And I'm assuming you chose that photograph of the sign that we see?
It cycles through several photographs. So if it's the Space for Rent one, that's
yes.
The one you're thinking of?
Right. And so you know, for the sake of our listeners who aren't looking at this, it's some kind of a sign that is clearly in front of something that's no longer open, and so half the sign is completely gone, and the place where the lettering is, some of the letters are missing or misplaced or whatever. I wonder if you could just say a word about what that photograph is meant to convey or suggest about the Obsolete Jobs Project.
Sure. So that was actually a photograph that I took in, I think it was Central Square in upstate New York. And I was interviewing at the time two pattern makers who have a workshop full of really awesome machines and are down the street from this strip mall that, you know, kind of used to be, I'm sure, full of small stores, big box stores, and now it's just overgrown with weeds. The whole parking lot is full of grass, and there's graffiti everywhere, and the signs are half down, and the whole area kind of had that feel. It's just kind of a rust belt area, and I think it was one of those situations where losing a few key industries really took out the entire town.
Hmm. So it is a sobering thing indeed. Let's talk about some of the very specific people that you have talked to and the kinds of things that you have learned from them. And it's interesting because some of these jobs, we might be surprised to see the word obsolete attached to them. But I think it depends on how one is utilizing the term. For instance, I know you've talked to multiple people who are miners, who are engaged in the mining industry, which still exists and, as far as I know, is going to always exist, albeit in much diminished fashion from what it once was. What was it like to speak with some of these miners, and what did they have to say to you?
Well, actually, mining was one of the interesting ones because, for the most part, the people that I spoke to really loved their jobs and hoped that they would not become obsolete. But at least one of the miners I spoke to said, look, this is a dangerous job. This is a job that if machines can do this and people don't, you know, go underground and risk their health and risk their safety, that's better. Let's have that happen. Which is a really interesting perspective, because I think a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, no matter what, we'd rather have people do it than have machines do it. But there's a lot of these jobs where there's an argument to be made that it's better for machines to do it.
And so that would set it apart from certain other kinds of jobs in which when that job vanishes, what was created in a sense vanishes with it.
Yes. I think that one was distinct in that sense. And as you said, it is a job where I think the peak was something like 800,000 coal miners in the U.S., and now we're down to about 50,000 coal miners.
Right.
And so we don't know that it will disappear entirely, and of course that depends on what sort of energy the country shifts toward. But even if there's still mining going on, the miners themselves may not be doing most of the mining.
How many of the people you have spoken to would we consider more engaged in blue-collar versus white-collar work? How many of these obsolete jobs tend to be one versus the other?
I guess it's difficult to say. A lot of them are sort of craftsman jobs that are kind of somewhere in between. So things like bookbinder or blacksmith. The factory jobs are certainly on the list, and I've talked to a number of people who've done things, you know, machinist kind of work. But I think there's an interesting split. Most of the people are kind of somewhere in the middle, and there's a lot of self-employment in these jobs as well.
I was intrigued by the very first picture that we see on the website in terms of I assume these are maybe the most recent people with whom you've spoken to, a young man named Matt, who is a movie projectionist. And of course, it's really easy if you don't really explore the topic to even realize that kind of thing is completely different from what it once was.
Sure, yeah, that's become, I mean, even in the last 20 years, the number of movie projectionists has halved. And before that, you know, going back to the sort of the heyday of people sitting up in the little booth and operating the entire machine, you know, there were many more people who did that now. But now, when I spoke to Matt, he said it's, you know, you press a button and walk away most of the time.
So what was your guiding purpose in putting together the Obsolete Jobs Project? What did you see it accomplishing beyond what might have been maybe the most obvious and simplest purpose, which would be to satisfy your own curiosity and the curiosity of others? But I suspect that there's an even larger purpose beyond that.
Yeah, so I guess I wasn't entirely sure what my purpose was as I set off, but it became more clear. I think, so I'm married to an economist, and we spend a lot of time talking about numbers, and we see the jobs reports and the unemployment rates and how it goes up and down, and that sort of big picture statistic misses the personal level. And so I wanted to go and find people and see what does it mean to be actually in the work that they're doing, and particularly for jobs that are becoming less common, we're running out of time to capture those stories.
Absolutely.
So I think of this as kind of an oral history project that captures the stories of people and also kind of gives us that human face on these big picture trends that we see in the news.
You are going to be coming to southeastern Wisconsin for this event Friday night that is titled Clock Out, A Conversation About the Future of Your Job. What are you planning to talk about at Friday's evening? Or what do you hope will happen Friday night?
Well, I'm hoping we're going to have a pretty good time. It's at a brewery rather than at the university, so we can all sort of have a drink and think about all of these things in a festive atmosphere. So I'm going to be sharing some of the stories. I'm bringing photographs, and I have voice clips as well, so you can sort of listen to people tell their own stories from all over the country. And I'm also going to be interviewing a local person on stage who has an obsolete, perhaps becoming obsolete job. And then we're going to kind of open it up and let people tell some of their stories. And it will be followed by trivia, to which I have contributed a couple of questions related to obsolete jobs.
Ah,
so I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. It sounds like a great night. Again, titled Clock Out, A Conversation About the Future of Your Job. That'll be 6 p.m. November 16th at Rustic Road Brewery Company, which is at 5706 6th Avenue. And the meet and greet begins at 6 p.m. And then your talk and presentation, as you said, followed by trivia. We want to remind people that the event is co-sponsored by the Wisconsin Humanities Council in partnership with Carthage College and Rustic Road Brewing Company. Holly Painter will be the special guest Friday night. Holly Painter, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I'm glad we got to talk.
Thank you for having me.
And the time is 8:26. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two out of The Morning Show archives.
Effort.
I'm excited to be talking once again with author and historian Thomas Fleming. More than 40 books are to his credit, including a book about Woodrow Wilson, about which we spoke, Mr. Fleming and I, a couple of years ago. Most recently, he wrote about the Revolutionary War era in a book which garnered a lot of attention called Duel, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Future of America. Today, we talk about his book called Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge. This is a Smithsonian book, an imprint of HarperCollins. And in it, we see, in effect, a different side of George Washington, our first president and the commander-in-chief during the Revolutionary War, and the kind of extraordinary challenges which he was confronting during those difficult days of Valley Forge. And along the way, we learn a great deal more about what life in America was like in these difficult days as we fought for our independence from Great Britain. It is not quite as tidy a story as many history books would have you think. And this book is one way for us to have a much more nuanced and detailed understanding of just what it meant to be an American at this point early in our history. Again, the book called Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge. Thomas Fleming, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, Greg, I'm delighted to be with you again.
Tell us, when one studies something as long ago as the Revolutionary War, I mean, I suppose in some ways it would be harder still to study the 30 Years' War or something, I mean, far earlier. But when we're talking about something which occurred more than 200 years ago, what are the resources which are at your disposal, and where do you find them, and how do you make your way through them?
There are there's an amazing amount of material that's been put together by scholarly presses that is in the big university libraries. A lot of people kept diaries. A lot of people wrote letters which they saved. It's just the letters of the delegates. minutes of the Continental Congress, for instance, fill over 7 volumes. And you can find out what they were thinking about Washington, among other things. And there's no dearth of material. This book could have been twice as long. I'm sort of launching a crusade against the tendency to write books that are too long these days.
So. Right. Let me ask you, too, when one is talking about this kind of firsthand information, I mean diaries or a letter which someone has written, I mean, whichever side you happen to be on, how does one figure out where the truth is in something about that? I mean, how do we know, for instance, that a given soldier isn't making honest mistakes or maybe even going out of their way to mischaracterize the events which they're observing in sort of the heated passion of the moment? Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, this is just like today. I think that one of the things that anybody who reads this book will say when they finish it is, things haven't changed very much. They're calling Washington the same kind of rotten names in this book that they're calling the president right now, or that they called the president Bill Clinton before him. We have always been a very outspoken people, and we tend to, I think, to it's human nature, though, to some extent, to be, when you're involved in great events, very meaningful events like the Revolution, where so much is at stake, emotions really run wild.
Hmm. Well, and of course, this book emerges at a moment in time when things are not going well for the Americans.
That is really the understatement of them all, Greg. But the Valley Forge, which today is a place that millions of tourists go to feel in touch with the heritage of heroism and endurance that now is... that the place has been enshrined as meaning, you know. But in late 1777 and early 78, when the whole ordeal was just beginning, it looked like a black hole into which the revolution was going to disappear.
Right. Tell us, first of all, about the city of Philadelphia and what had occurred not long before Valley Forge, the falling of Philadelphia, if you will.
Right. Philadelphia was the loss of Philadelphia was the source of most of Washington's woes at Valley Forge. The British had invaded Pennsylvania in late August of 1777, and Washington had marched his army to fight them. Everyone understood that the prize was Philadelphia. He lost 2 battles in the course of this struggle. Actually, 3, although he wasn't the commander of the 3rd battle, which we call the Paoli Massacre, in which part of Washington's army was ambushed by the British and practically just almost wiped out. But at any rate, Philadelphia was the 3rd biggest city in the British Empire. It was it was almost 40,000 people, which made it the biggest city in America. And it was a very wealthy city. It drew on all of this rich farmland all around it. So that each year, Philadelphia was exporting tens of thousands of tons of wheat and corn and iron to Europe. This was really, we tend to think, one of the big mistakes about the American Revolution is, as I said in more than one book, is that the image of the primitive frontier clings to the revolution. But America had been going for 150 years at this point, and it was a very sophisticated society that had developed. We were producing one-seventh of all the iron in the world at this point. Philadelphia, it all came through Philadelphia, and they were very well-to-do set of people. And when the British captured this city, it was a terrific blow to the American morale, and a great many people turned on Washington as the man who was responsible for it.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting when you say turned on Washington, we have to probably hasten to add that they're not turning on Washington, D.C. There's no such place yet.
That's
they're
right.
turning
yeah.
on
General,
the man.
They turned on General Washington.
On General Washington.
The first chapter of the book, Greg, which you'll recall, I think sums up what was going on. My title is George Washington, Loser.
Right. And the fact that these defeats which had been suffered by the Americans, there was this that really dissipated what had been kind of the air of invincibility about George Washington. He had been such a revered military hero from earlier conflicts.
His reputation had soared at the end of 1776 when he scored these two dramatic victories at Trenton and Princeton, which actually rescued the situation after he had suffered a whole series of defeats before that. He lost the battle for New York and had to retreat across New Jersey, but he did come back with these marvelous triumphs, and the press and everybody else rushed to sing his praises, and he was at a very high level. But here's what happened. Another thing, Greg, it's politics and life. Another general emerged who looked better than Washington. While Washington was losing two battles and losing Philadelphia, General Horatio Gates was fighting a British army in northern New York, just north of Albany, and he won. He beat the General Burgoyne, the commander of that army, and captured this whole British army. And pretty soon, there were all kinds of people in the Continental Congress and in newspapers and so forth who were thinking that General Gates was the guy they needed, not George Washington.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the Continental Congress, because this is really a fascinating story as well about, among other things, how the whole character of the Continental Congress had changed so drastically, and in one respect especially. You say of the political leaders of 1776 who voted for independence, only six remained in the present Congress. I mean, at the time that we're talking about now with Valley Forge. You say most of the delegates had never met George Washington. To them, he was only a name. Washington was equally unacquainted with the new men in power, and there was little in their conduct that inspired respect.
All of that is absolutely true, and it was this really that you put your finger on the heart of Washington's problem at Valley Forge. He really couldn't get these people to listen to him for quite a while, their hostility to him could be summed up very graphically, I guess you'd say. They decided, Washington requested that they send a committee to the army so he could talk things over and discuss the real problems that were threatening the survival of the army and the country. And so James Lovell, who was one of the right-hand men of Samuel Adams, who was the leader of Congress, Adams was in Boston for a brief vacation, and Lovell wrote about this delegation that was going to see Washington. He assured Adams that they would be going to camp to rap a demigod over the knuckles.
Hmm.
The contempt with which Lovell regarded Washington, and which was echoed by, he was echoing Sam Adams's attitude. These people had a lot of the Congress anyway had a very hostile attitude towards a regular army. They were spooked by the story of Oliver Cromwell and how he became a dictator in the previous century, and they kept seeing the possibility that Washington's regular army would turn into a Cromwellian dictatorship, and so they always were on there, were bugging the army and really not being very helpful. They were trying to force the army to put up with their ideas of how the war should be run and how the army should be supplied, which were all terrible ideas. It was they didn't really know what the devil they were doing.
Hmm. Let's talk about the supplies, the meager supplies with which the American army was living at this point, and especially through the misery of Valley Forge. I mean, the stories are staggering of the number of soldiers who did not have something as basic as shoes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Their uniforms had worn out, and their shoes shoes were not very well made in those days. But you needed constant replacements, and the Congress just hadn't gotten around to producing any. I have in the book. I have this story of an officer on Washington's staff who said that he had three well-heeled, wealthy businessmen who were ready to set up a factory and produce 150,000 shoes in a year that would keep Washington's men in shoes for the next couple of years. Congress wouldn't even listen to him.
Hmm.
Why? Because that was bad to make money from the war. Sam Adams and the people around him in Congress were convinced that patriotism should be completely disinterested. Anyone who profited from the war was bad, evil, and so forth. And Washington had to fight this attitude, this idea, too, which he did. He really, there's some startling stuff in the book about Washington's statements Washington made about patriotism, and which sums up, can be summed up very quickly by saying, he said, patriotism is not enough all by itself to win a war. You have to appeal, you have to, patriotism is important, but you also have to give men a stake. They have to be permitted to achieve certain things they need in order to keep survive and to help the country survive.
I mean, it's an interesting flip, because what we end up seeing is George Washington in effect a paragon of patriotism. I mean, this person we see in mythical dimensions,
yes,
actually being at this moment in time a very practical person, speaking very practically to the people in the Congress, and they were the ones spouting platitudes about patriotism, thinking that's what was going to sustain them through this difficult effort.
Right. It was a false demonstration. It was a false idea of patriotism. They were printing money with no, and they weren't taxing anybody, so that meant that the money started to depreciate, and yet they insisted that farmers should sell their cattle and food and wheat rather to the army. For prices that Congress set the previous year, and they ignored the fact that the money was depreciating, and the farmers, instead of selling, hid their cattle in the woods and their wheat in the barns, and that was the chief reason why the army was starving.
Hmm. You also talk about how when fervent, desperate calls were made upon the Congress to get more resources to the army, more often than not, again, this is the more things change, the more they stay the same, almost always they would confront difficult questions by forming a committee. You said into the hundreds, eventually into the thousands of committees that were formed to study and talk about these things instead of taking action, which is
right,
what was most needed.
That exactly. They refused to set up executive departments. This was the primitive form of government that we created in the Revolution, and only by really painful lessons did we realize that Congress all by itself can't really do it all.
Hmm.
They eventually slowly learned to set up departments and so forth, and then finally in the Constitutional Convention, which now, you know, we're getting ahead, way ahead, but 20 years later they realized that there had to be an executive department of the government in order to execute the laws and policies that Congress set up. But these lessons had not yet been learned, but people like Washington, the amazing thing is the people like Washington were learning them and making Congress listen to them.
Absolutely. The other part of this story, of course, which is so interesting, you've already mentioned it, is the contention between General Washington and General Gates.
Yeah.
This general who was thought by some to be the person who should really take things over.
Right.
And you say that through the course of this story, we begin to see this side of George Washington who really, he understands how to go after not only his enemies in red uniforms, the British,
yeah,
but also he knows how to go after enemies from within his own ranks, so to speak.
He proves the whole idea of this book, or the most important idea, I think. Anyway, there are others. Ideas in it, of course, is Washington's emergence as a really good politician. He knew how to form alliances with some of the people in the Continental Congress. He knew how to take the offensive. That's a great idea, you know, an important idea from military thinking, that you seize the initiative. Well, he did the same thing in politics. He wrote tough letters to people saying, I understand that you just said to General Gates that I am an idiot, words to that effect, you know? Is that true? And General Conway, the guy who wrote this letter, was, he was completely flabbergasted that Washington was fighting back. All of these critics of Washington were heaping these attacks on him. They assumed that eventually Washington, they completely misjudged him. They assumed that this very dignified, rather reserved man would just quietly decide that nobody liked him, and he resigned his commission and go back to Mount Vernon.
And no such thing.
Were they wrong?
Yeah, he wasn't. Washington wasn't going anywhere.
No, of course,
eventually things begin to sort of fall apart for General Gates. Things go wrong in all kinds of different ways. Eventually, those who had heaped all kinds of criticism upon Washington and all kinds of praise on Gates sort of had to eat crow and sort of slink back to the side of George Washington, who in many different ways managed to reassert himself.
Exactly.
As,
the great thing about it, Greg, is that he did it so well. He defeated these guys. And the next thing you know, as I say in the book, all these congressmen were making speeches and writing letters to their constituents saying, I never had a negative word to say about that great man, George Washington. In fact, they were saying all kinds of terrible things, but they just denied it. But then he just let it go. He did not hold a grudge against these guys who had tried to destroy him. Instead, he re-enlisted most of them, you might say, in the struggle for independence.
Along the way, aside this central story, which in and of itself is so fascinating, we learn a whole lot about life in those days. And in particular, for instance, the role of the Quakers during the Revolutionary War times and the interesting role which they found themselves playing. Just talk briefly about this very interesting story.
It's a Quaker story, it's rather sad. They were carried away by extremists in their ranks who interpreted the idea that they were against war, and they blamed the Americans for starting the war. And so as a result, they refused to pay taxes to the rebel government. They wouldn't help American soldiers, even when they were starving in prisons in Philadelphia. Their idea was they had to have nothing to do with this evil war in every way, shape, and form, even though it was being fought by their own countrymen. And I'm happy to say that after the war, they realized this was a mistake, and they never did this again. But they were carried away by their own ideology, I guess you'd say, their deep faith in their own religion and this detestation of war, and it was a difficult time for them to be Quakers. A lot of them were harassed and their windows were broken in Philadelphia. 19 of their leaders were arrested and sent out of the state of Pennsylvania into western Virginia. They had a very hard time at this point in the Revolution.
You also remind us that this was a time in which there was some real class disparity in this young nation. And that was something which made some of these issues a bit complicated.
I mean,
the difference between the very wealthy and the very poor.
Well, there was about the same distribution of wealth in 1776 America as there is today. As I already said, America has been going for 150 years. A very sophisticated and wealthy society had arisen, and as everything of that sort. There were some people who were very, very successful and others who were not. And the have-nots, particularly in Pennsylvania, which was the wealthiest, Philadelphia in that area, and Pennsylvania, which they particularly resented the tendency of the rich to assume that they were going to run the government and so forth. So in Pennsylvania, the Revolution assumed you might call it a leveling quality. There was a lot of really vicious statements made about rich people and how they should be, their money should be taken away from them and so forth and so forth. This added a lot of tension to the Revolution in Pennsylvania. It really made it very difficult for Washington to fight the war there.
It's just interesting, I think, because it helps us appreciate the American victory. And one realizes when you read some of these stories that that was not a foregone conclusion. That
no way.
We're, in many respects, we're really fortunate that there is a United States of America today, because all kinds of things, if they'd just gone a little bit more wrong than they went wrong, that entire war might have turned out entirely differently. I mean, that was a very real possibility.
Oh, well, without George Washington, I honestly don't think it would have been won, Greg. And I got to tell you, my favorite line, which I have at the, toward the end of the book, one of the Washington's worst critics was a guy named Dr. Benjamin Rush. He wrote smear letters against Washington, anonymous smear letters that he sent all over the place and so forth. Anyway, at the end of 1778, when Washington had, you know, scored this political triumph and Congress was praising him, Benjamin Rush said, "George Washington has more influence in the Continental Congress than George III has in the British Parliament."
Hmm.
I find that very amusing.
Well, especially on the heels of all that you tell us through the pages of this fascinating book. Again, it is called Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge. And in addition to all we've talked about in this interview, we learn a great deal about just how difficult those days of Valley Forge were. It's an extraordinary story. The book is published by Smithsonian Books, an imprint of HarperCollins, and the author, Thomas Fleming. Thomas Fleming, once again, you are responsible for a truly fascinating and important book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
Lovers of film, and especially classic films, are going to enjoy the next few minutes, I'm sure. I know I will. I'm excited to speak.
And the time is 8:51 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Yesterday, of course, was Veterans Day, and it was 100 years marked the end of the First World War, the so-called Great War. In honor of this special Veterans Day, I want to play for you the very moving music of John Williams, which is called Hymn to the Fallen. It actually comes from the World War II film Saving Private Ryan. Hymn to the Fallen, in honor of all those who have fallen in defense of our country and our liberty.
Hymn to the Fallen by John Williams. The time is 8:58. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Ionai Mitroff, the author of a hard-hitting book called Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age. On Wednesday, in honor of the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, I'll be playing excerpts from several different interviews from The Morning Show archives, including Andrew Carroll's book My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War, also Patrick O'Donnell's book The Unknowns, The Untold Story of America's Unknown Soldier and World War I's Most Decorated Heroes Who Brought Him Home, and finally Thomas Fleming, whom we heard from today, his book The Illusion of Victory, Americans in World War I. Also a brief excerpt from my interview with Robert Laplander, who was featured in the American Experience documentary film called The Great War. On Thursday, we'll preview for you the opera workshop at Carthage this weekend, which is called To Schubert. It recreates one of the so-called Schubertiads, which would be gatherings of friends and admirers of Schubert's to celebrate his music. So this presentation called To Schubert is Saturday afternoon at